right, you have already heard from Matt Simpson, Trevor Daly, and Kaylee Yakov. Interesting to hear her perspective on all things the Rahal Ducati team. I gave her some compliments by way of one Colin Fraser, who now joins us. I told her, Colin, I said he was down the chicane. He wanted to see who was sticking to the track. He was making it through there smoothly. I said that you were somebody who noticed it. You liked what they were doing early on. So she was very, very complimentary of the fact that you enjoyed watching, seeing the team come together very quickly, which was nice. But also that team, interesting to see how they've evolved throughout the weekend and their first official weekend being together and not just going through testing and racing and all the rest. Colin Fraser, Cam Beckle with me here as we set you up for race day is what this is going to be officially at Daytona. It is the Daytona 200. Got another podcast for you coming out that we're going to maybe tease later on in the show. But for right now, we're just focused on what went down on Friday. What is going to this whole thing look like going into Saturday? Colin, I'll begin with you. Let's just go into the thing that we left people off with when we discussed most recently. Sebastian Tremblay had his qualifying one time deleted, went into qualifying two in the morning here on Friday, and there were no Canadians who made it first and foremost into the top 12 in the time attack. But Sebastian Tremblay, how do you deem his recovery in terms of what he was able to accomplish?
I think it was another strong effort, what we expect from Sebastian. He's a smart guy and makes good decisions. He doesn't have his whole team. He doesn't have the bike he'd like to be riding.
Right.
He had a mix-up yesterday, and it turns out all of our discussions about the minutia of the specific rules for this event and FIM Supersport and whatnot was really like a complete red herring, because what happens, and this is very important, this level of racing, and particularly a European base for world championship events, there's kind of a you show me yours and I'll show you mine situation at the end of sessions, which is called parc fermé. All the bikes have to be left on their stands in a central area with nobody touching them, and that allows all the teams to have a look at them. And of course, the person most likely to point out that you're cheating is someone else riding the same brand of motorcycle, because they recognize from prepping their bike what you might be up to with yours. But if you don't take your bike to parc fermé, then the process doesn't start. So that was the problem for Sebastian. He doesn't, maybe had never been involved in a parc fermé situation, although in Canada you do it with the top five. But here I think they do it with everyone for a specific amount of time, and then they tell you what they're going to check in tech.
Right.
So the mechanics come back, and then you start doing whatever you're doing. And his bike did, I mentioned, come back surprisingly early.
Yes.
That's why.
Yes, and that would be because he didn't make the trip, which is an easy way to get through that. I will say, parc fermé in this specific situation, the Daytona 200, it has been really interesting to me because, you know, I wander past it at various points, whether it be the super sport category that's competing in the Daytona 200 or otherwise, and you see, you know, Scott Cartier or anybody who's a team tech or an engineer, and they're just kind of doing the Adrian Newey. It's the arms crossed. They just kind of get to wander down and stare at the other bikes and go, okay, that's what a Suzuki GSX car 750
well,
looks like
also
when you're here.
Also here, there's a whole other layer, because normally we're looking at each other's tires, but there's hardly ever a surprise. But now you might be looking at a tire that you know nothing about, and you're trying to figure out how does that tire work. And I find it interesting that everybody thinks the other tires are good, but you know the other two brands, i.e. the two brands we're not running for whatever the reason, just aren't quite up to what we're doing. And of course, where we are, we're basically everybody's on a Bridgestone. It's not like we're gathering a lot of data comparing our tire to our tire.
But this is what makes me kind of laugh, is the idea of, okay, go wander down there to parc fermé and you see people staring at tires, but it's like, you don't know how many laps they did on those, right? And so, like, what are you actually learning, I guess, in that situation?
Well, I think that it goes with everything else at Daytona. We jump to some conclusions and then cook up some information. And, you know, I mean, a huge issue here constantly is my bike doesn't have forward grip. It doesn't have traction. And the tires are hard because of the banking. The track is heavily used. They run a 24-hour sports car race with some very big, heavy cars with downforce and great big wide tires. This has never, ever, in the whole history of this place, ever been a good place for tires. And way back in the 70s, some of the most spectacular failures in the history of tires happened. Barry Sheen almost died here with a tire failure that unfortunately made it into a BBC documentary they were shooting about him. So yeah, lots and lots of people have had tire problems, tires coming apart, chunking, going flat, rubbing on things because they expand because of the long time speed, high speed of spinning. You know, it's everything's working harder at Daytona.
The only thing I saw today that terrified me, Cam, was King of the Baggers. There was some body work that came flying off after the chicane in today's first race for them. And I honestly,
that by the way, that's not that unusual in that category.
Yeah. And I was standing with some people who were saying, oh, it's just a little piece. Oh, it's good. It slid all the way down the 38 degree banking. It goes all the way down to the bottom. And then somebody goes, yeah, it's about an $1,800 chunk of racing if you want to buy that directly from Harley Davidson. It's like it was a big chunk and a big moment in that race. I think they ended up having a red flag situation as well in that race today on the Friday, but they're going to be back out there on the Saturday. But what jumped out for you, Cam, in terms of what you saw here on the Friday of the Super Sport category?
Well, the one guy that we haven't got to who sort of impressed me today was Trevor Daley. And he's sort of been I don't want to say the forgotten man on that side of the garage, but let's face it, Ben Young's a three-time champion, and he's always done well at Daytona. He got maybe a little more of the headlines. Trevor Daley has had really, really strong pace the whole time that we've been here. He got up to speed very quickly today. He's the third Canadian inside the top 30. Inside the top 30. He's in 30th going into tomorrow's race. And, some people might look at that at face value and think, oh, well, he's 30th. That's, maybe kind of right around the range that some of our guys have been in the last couple of years. But with the pace that we've seen the rest of the field have, that's, an incredible benchmark for him to be in. And, to be running with Trevor Dion, who's on, arguably as good a package as anybody, and to be within earshot of Ben Young, who's in his fourth time doing this, I think it's a pretty impressive showing.
Yeah, Trevor Dion on Dunlops, and right beside him is Trevor Daley, and Trevor Daley built the bike he's on. No offense to Dion, that didn't have much to do with him. He wasn't laying any wrenches on the machine.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say, based on the hype that maybe it's just we in terms of the guy sitting over here, Cam and myself, but that we thought Trevor Dion, based on what we thought he was going to be on coming in, would be not light years ahead of Ben Young or Trevor Daley, but in terms of the A group CSBK riders, I think I had the expectation that it would be Dion maybe in that 12 to 15, maybe Ben Young would be 15 to 18, and that Trevor might be somewhere in that 18 to 22. Like, that was kind of the thinking I had, was these three guys are going to be in these spots. It's a super competitive field. It's international. It's super talented. And I thought they would be in those spots. And we've gone through it now. And I'm waiting to see it. By the way, CSBK riders dominated Group B. Let's just say that. Let's just throw that out there. I know it's Group B, but it was kind of fun because, I was watching from one of the grandstands this morning on Friday, and I saw a guy who basically reached over to me and goes, who are you cheering for? And I go, oh, it's just the Canadian guys. I'm here covering them, and I'm interested in what they're going to do. And he said, well, my brother is Blake Davis. And it was him and all of his hometown friends from Lynchburg, Virginia, and they were all standing there, and they're all, every single lap that he comes around on a blue bike and a white helmet, they're whipping him through, and he made the time attack at the end of the day. He's a super talented guy. And
also, maybe the nicest and most polite person in the paddock, even when there's a lot of Canadians.
Right.
He has a wonderful reputation, and he's had some serious success in the lower category.
Well, his brother actually said to me, he goes, I hate him. He's making so much money down here doing all this fun stuff, and I got to go home and work on Monday and all the rest. But he was like, they're there and excited for Blake and what he was doing. But he said, who are you cheering for? And I basically said, nobody. I'm just interested in what they're doing. And he goes, well, you guys have been running really well in Group B. Like, we've noticed. And I thought, yeah, it's a weird thing to be proud of, but at the same time, it's when you see that there's three Canadians up in that group in A, and then you see what they did in Group B, it is kind of something to be proud of, because based on what the expectation was, yes, the top time in Group B was going to be, what, 29th, 30th, 31st, basically, when you're talking about Group A?
Unless you're Maximilian Girardo, who almost got a spot in the top 12. But yeah, no, generally, I mean, Group E is looked at as the air quotes slower group.
But you don't need the air quotes. It's the slow, like, let's be honest. And everybody, particularly Sebastian Tremblay, because he's won titles in Canada, you know, he wanted to be in Group A because then you're riding with faster people all the time.
Well, you mentioned that on our preview podcast. It was like, who you ride with will determine the pace that pushes you, that creates what you become.
And I think you were you mentioned this and kind of got away from it. You know that that Young was in that group is no surprise. He has a history in the series. He was very fast last year, but you could say that Trevor Dion, in my opinion, at the very start of this week at the Dunlop Test at Savannah, Georgia, the word got back about how he was riding, and that moved him up. And Daly, given he's never competed in the 200, it was fortunate for him to get into that group too. And you know, group B, I think is a little bit more like CSBK, and those guys are all grinding it out. And it was remarkable, A, how much time they all spent together.
Yes.
But I'm looking at the grid, they're all on the grid together. Which, you know, from a photographer's point of view, let's hope we get enough of that to get a gang shot. But there's always the fear that they turn this into Mosport and go nuts, right? And 57 laps, please nurse the tires and pace yourself, right?
Do you, honest question here. Do you think that there is a conversation? Because we've been spending a lot of time in the Bridgestone paddock over the last couple of days. Do you think there is a conversation? Because there are so many guys from that Group B collection that are going to be starting close to each other, where they get together and they go, listen, you're 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33. Like, let's figure this thing out together. Do you think there's a conversation at all that will happen? Because to me, and again, I come at this from a completely different world, which is team sport football. But I do know that the best thing in order to create positive momentum based on watching practice, Q1, Q2, and the time attack is people that figure out how to cohesively work together and find a way to create momentum to guide themselves forward. I'm not saying that all of a sudden out of nowhere, Maverick Sear, Sebastian Tremblay, and Sam Garin are going to become, you know, the Yamaha Austrian racing team. But what I'm saying is it'd be a hell of a thing if those three guys were to talk to each other and say, listen, we can create more momentum together than we can do apart.
So Cam needs to answer this, and then the cynic will weigh in.
Okay.
I think in theory going into the race, they would like to think that way, that we can work together on this thing. I think, you know, a lot of guys would like to approach it that way. The problem for me as a fan, not as a former racer, is I look at a lot of races in that sort of context where guys sometimes might agree in their helmet that, yes, we should work together, and I can be the one that can lead this group. And then the next guy says, well, no, I can be the one that can lead this group. And before you know it, you have a 6 or 7 rider battle, all thinking that, yes, let's work together with me at the front, with me setting the pace. And you have guys end up slowing each other down in the middle stint. And hopefully we avoid that. But I think the bigger reality is you have to get through the first phase before you can really start worrying about that.
And I guess turn 1/2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Like, if you can make it through...
That's the whole infield.
Right, right. But what I'm saying is, if you can make it through the infield and climb the banking, which you know I know after today, Colin, I mean, I'm an expert in all things inside the infield. But what I'm saying is, if you can make it through the infield with those guys from the CSBK Bridgestone paddock, essentially here at Daytona, if you can make it through that, get up onto the banking, feed off of each other, then you can start to sort yourself out. And I think what we are all thinking, before I get to the cynic as you preview, is the idea that, okay, they've set themselves up in these spots. How did they set themselves up now for success and not cause each other the greatest amount of headaches going into Saturday afternoon?
Well, we know Sebastian Tremblay is the natural person to take the lead on this role just by nature of his ability and how he's raced and the experience he has. We know he has no faith in anyone else. He's had some bad experiences trusting people, and he would prefer to be left alone, but that's not how it works when you're Sebastian Tremblay. Somebody like Sear, from his demeanor on the track and from our conversation with him earlier, he would follow Tremblay and mind his own business, right? He would follow Tremblay across the infield to the snack bar, you know, go out across the road to Panera's and have a sandwich. He would make the long view because he's early in his career. My issue here, and it's easy to pick on Samuel Grant, and I really enjoy Samuel Grant, but you know Samuel, if he's in a position to start picking people off, he is not going to overthink the problem, right? He's going to Grant.
But here's my question is like, and I understand what you are saying, and I agree with you because I can totally see that happening. The other thing that's interesting to me is the idea of, okay, if Sebastian Tremblay is the natural one to lead that group, but he gets backed up into by, you know, at the International Horseshoe, and all of a sudden there's a backup. Everybody gets backed up, and all of a sudden, like we saw in the Super Hooligan race on the Friday, where you start seeing three guys just separate themselves. And it's like, well, everybody else is playing for fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. And I do wonder what the frustration level becomes there. But at the same time, if you are Samuel Grand and you want to start picking people off and you want to go ahead and find Tremblay and lead this group, and there's not all that much benefit to actually leading at this track. Like, there's a difference of this track, Cam, to other places because of the amount of drafting and because of the banking and all the rest, where even if Samuel wants to run out in front and try and run away from everybody else, it's just not possible unless you're going to dominate the entire track. And that's what I find so interesting is the mentality here is, sure, you might apply what you're talking about, Colin, but it's not going to play the same in this spot.
Yeah, I think, you know, most of that from what we've seen the last couple of years and really throughout the history of Daytona is less about, to me, less about any sort of mentality of, you know, I need to push to get away from these guys, or I need to hang in this group, and more about just the consistency in your laps. You know, it's definitely not easy to put a good lap around Daytona, but it's a lot easier to put, you know, one or two good laps together in Q1 or Q2. It's a lot harder to string 57 flawless laps together. Yeah. And so I think when you get into, you know, lap 10, lap 20, lap 30, you know, it's more about how many mistakes have I made? How many, you know, bad laps have I put together? Because if you've put together a few bad laps, you might start to settle in a little bit more and say, okay, you know, I need to salvage this and keep myself in the running, thinking that there might be a red flag, you know, near the end or some sort of sprint scenario. If you're someone who's put together a pretty good race, you might be more likely to keep charging.
What do you have an eye on there?
So a couple things to mention. I don't think Tremblay's bike is all that fast. I think he's been riding it really well, and he's been smart, and he's worked the traffic, so that could be a problem. Maybe somebody doesn't want to wait for him anymore. Looking at the grid, it's amazing. So row 12, Tremblay. Row 13 and 38th is Garin. 39th is Sear. Fourth is Brad McRae, who we've hardly mentioned. He hasn't been happy with how things are going. But, you know, the reality is, imagine we have a late red. Those guys have been running for a while. They're used to the tires. They're getting to know the track. They've been racing. All of those guys think what Elliott Vieira did on the restart last year is what they're capable of. 14th, 15th, yep. And get some decent money and come back and maybe be the best Canadian, depending. You know, those guys are all focused on Ben Young, right? Because that's who clearly is the king of Kensington in our Bridgestone ghetto. So Young, I think, could have been 9th or 10th last year if things had played out the way they were looking. Yeah. He got scrubbed off. His bike was dreadfully slow, and he was just remarkably fast on a dud of a bike that was legitimately 25 horsepower down from what it needed to be. Hmm. So, you know, Ben Young will march forward if the bike's consistent and he can ride it. And, you know, the nice thing about the 750 Suzuki is it's not tweaked aggressively. It's practically a stock engine. So it'll be durable, and it should be a good bike to pull the tall gearing regularly. Where Young goes, because another thing I like about Ben Young is he knows those people at the front. He's raced with a lot of them. So he in his head knows he belongs with them. And last year on a poor motorcycle, he was riding with them. But, you know, if Ben's out, it just turns into a lottery. And some of the people in the middle there, the two Trevors in particular, are a little less known. Whereas we can't help but think Tremblay, left on his own, will make a lot out of not much.
Mm, interesting. What would you say, I guess, how would you define the term or the quality in Ben Young that you think might allow him to make some noise in this race? Is it racecraft? Is it, because you were just touching on it, like, is it the knowledge of the guys around him? Is it understanding? Is it patience? Is it, like, what is the thing that you think gives him the ability in this race that if we're sitting here 24 hours from now and we're talking about Ben Young top 10, top five, whatever it might end up being, if he makes some noise in this race and we're sitting here discussing it, what will lead to that?
Well, I think you listed off a large array of top qualities you'd look for in a racer. And he's a mature racer. He's a three-time champion. He's well into his career. And I think the big thing is that he understands all these things. He makes mistakes. Racers make mistakes. It's how things go. Things go wrong. He's realistic about it. He makes, you know, you look at what happened at Grand Bend. He fell down. They scrambled. They missed the start. And
round one where the seat falls off,
yeah,
too.
You know, he can salvage things if he needs to. Obviously, he doesn't want to be there, and he's been doing this for a long time. His whole group is very savvy. They're a strong set of people. They've worked through some problems. I believe that their pit stops will look as good as the very top teams, and I think that's going to be quite interesting early on because there are several teams, and of course, we can't help but talk about those Yamaha Endurance guys. I think everybody can't wait to see their pit stops to see if they really can be that good because it looks like 8 seconds would be a great pit stop, and if you're good, but a little bit careful, it's probably 12 or 13. That's 5 seconds on a green track. There is a speed limit here. You have to meet the speed limit or you get hit with a penalty. And of course, if there's a red flag and a restart, then how fast your pit stops are becomes less important. And there's all that tire strategy. And the problem is, we have no idea. Is this going to be 2 years ago when one guy gambles on holding on to an old tire and makes it work? Is it last year when they had that crazy battle slipstream right to the end, which was, you know, honestly, to me, almost frightening to see these fast motorcycles with these top guys running so close lap after lap because they couldn't break free in the draft. And, you know, Josh Herron came to the front because I think he is a guy with that confidence in that situation. And I think the other guys are intimidated because they know he looks at it that way.
The pit stops, something that we've talked about here, we've talked about with Greg White, which, by the way, finally the tease pays off. Greg White is the other podcast episode that you will hear here on the Bridgestone CSBK podcast, but the whole concept of pit stops is so intriguing to me because there was the pit stop challenge tonight, and it was played on the PA system, right? And it was the top end people, and there was money up for grabs, and it was, you know, thousands and thousands. And but when that was done, everybody else was going out and getting their reps in and final preparations and all the rest. Whether it was the teams at the, you know, top end of the grid or all the way down to the bottom, you walk along the hot pit and it was, everybody was going out at different times, but just trying to get acquainted with all of this. And what I'm so interested in this, not just for Team Battle Axe here with Bridgestone, but all of the CSPK riders is, yeah, it's been fun. You know, everybody's done the stops and done the practices. And when it hits lap 19, lap 20, I genuinely wonder what the heart rate is of the people who are sitting there waiting to bring in Sebastian Tremblay, where it's like, we've got a real chance to make a difference for this guy. He's running really well through the first third of this race. We can make a difference. Let's go and get him out of here as quickly as possible. The idea of trying to get people out and give them an opportunity to win this race is pretty special. And there's so much pressure on people that nobody really knows, right? Like, this is the funny thing is when you're talking about pit crews, it's just, it's these anonymous figures who are sitting there trying to help out the team. And if they do a great job, you might end up seeing the guy that they represent standing on top of the podium or being a top five or a top 10 at the end of the day, but they will never get any love whatsoever. They're a huge part, Cam, of what this might look like coming up tomorrow.
Well, I think they get the love within the paddock, you know, you hope, but certainly maybe not with the fans. But I think your point goes kind of to something we talked about this morning in the morning episode, with the familiarity within a team when it comes to this specific event and any sort of, you know, endurance racing like this. You know, Ben Young is a guy who has that advantage in the sense that he was here last year with largely the same team helping him. He's done it 4 times, the first 2 times not with largely the same team, but some of the same people around. And none of the other riders here from Canada have had a Daytona pit stop before. So, you know, I think when you talk about the nerves, you know, a lot of the people on Ben Young's side of the wall, they can still make mistakes. Certainly everyone can, you know, the teams that have been doing this for 30 years can make mistakes, but they might not have that same pressure because they've been through it a couple of times and they know, you know, what the process is, what the little things are that they're going to do, what their responsibilities are, more than someone who might be, you know, holy bleep, I'm standing on the pit wall of Daytona on lap 20 and I got to make sure this guy has the best pit stop it was like.
And I'm so interested in this too, because it's like, okay, even if you crush the first one, you're not done.
Well, also,
you still got the second one to go through, right?
I talked to two different teams about fuel mileage. And of course, we're at that point where we're trying to figure out how the guys are riding, if they're in the draft, what the mileage could be. If you're alone, your mileage is going to drop. So, you know, the window theoretically is 18 to 22 laps. If you have to come in at 18, the math doesn't work out to do this race in two stops. So anybody who comes in early, there's a question there about that. If you can get to 20 or for sure 21, and don't forget that if there's that red flag, the situation you're in about what you're allowed to do during the red flag comes into play. So early on, that first set of pit stops, see what the lap count is, right? Because that is going to give us our clue into who's struggling with mileage. And there are some new configurations, and it's my opinion, based on limited knowledge, that the GSXRs are not consistent in their mileage. So there's a lot of those 750s, and from what I know, my limited slice of the information is they're not getting all the same mileage. So that could be fun. And of course, like, yeah, for instance, not that long, 2 years ago, Herron looked like he was going to do it and pushed his pit stop too far, ran out, coasted in, and then because he ran it dry, he had to cycle the ignition, only they forgot to, and then had a terrible pit stop because once they got everything done, they couldn't get the bike to start for an electronic issue, not a failure, just they, in the heat of the moment, the thing the average street guy knows, they forgot.
Well, and I think also when you're talking about potential reds, you know, we've talked a lot about how much faster the pace is this year. Maybe not necessarily at the front, although the pace is faster at the front. You have some top-end talent, but especially in the midfield. When you look at the midfield, it's so much deeper, and that pace is so much stronger, but also so much closer within the midfield. When you compare it to last year, there was gaps of a second and a half between riders. Now you have 10 guys within, you know, 0.2. And again, it's harder to do that across 57 laps, but when you have a pack of 10 guys now suddenly fighting over 26th. Not only do you have the potential for more on-track incidents, but you have, I would think, you know, more potential for strategy of I can, you know, get a jump on these 8 guys in this pack in front of me if I can stretch this out a little bit longer, and that's when you can run into some more interesting scenarios.
And we're not used to pit stops, so all of your normal discussion in most kinds of automobile racing, the undercut and how the math works and the length of the pit lane and how long you're on the limiter, and the pit lane here technically
so
is
good.
Ridiculously long, right? Because the pit lane doesn't end technically till the first horseshoe, which is really turn 3. So there, you know, the Josh Hayeses of the world who really know this place backwards have a huge advantage. And I think Cam's point about people where their lap times are really close, in theory, if you gear your bike right and you run at the back, then that makes you much safer in terms of just getting that last little bit of mileage that'll push you to the point that you know you only have to make 2 stops.
And I would also say Josh Herron, when he won last year, what we saw from him on that long, because for people that don't know, you know, you have the pit limiter on. It's a long pit lane like you're talking about. You get to the end. You got to take that left, and then you got to curve all the way around through a little bit of weaving all the way around to the right. And I've seen people rejoining, whether it be practice, qualifying sessions, otherwise, being respectful of those that are coming out of that corner. That's not going to happen in the race at all. Like, you are full throttle coming out like Herron was at various points throughout the race, both of his stops back last season. So I'm really interested to see what that meshing looks like of people coming back out and not being kind whatsoever, but also in terms of the pit stop strategy and practice. Team Battle Axe held practice tonight, and I know I was recording with Matt Simpson and talking to Trevor Daly and all the rest, and they were prepping things and getting it going and all the rest. And, you know, you might have heard on this podcast that Trevor Daly said, you know, we've got this time and we think that we can get this time. And it's been relatively consistent and we feel like everybody's got a good understanding. And I was actually like packing up my stuff and leaving. And I saw Trevor with his, you know, full leathers on, comes riding in, park it, front tire, back tire. Yep. Gas. Good. chain, good, back tire, good, on, push. And then somebody yelled out, 9.5. And the whole garage went, woo! Like, everybody in the place was just like, hey, if we do that on Saturday, we're in a good spot, guys. Like, and it was the first shot that they had at it, too, because I watched it live with my own eyes, and I saw the excitement in all of them go, oh, we really just did that, right? And that's just one, that's one garage, that's one pit. But it's like the strategy of trying to stagger Ben alongside Trevor is also going to be interesting, because who comes in first? Whose tire wear is worse? What is their track position? Where do they want to release them?
Well, the standard policy is the teammate who's furthest forward is right. The first one to come in. Now imagine you're with the M4 X-Star Vision Wheels guys. There's an awful lot of those bikes that all look the same that all have to be serviced. And think about that lap count I mentioned, which is like a 3-lap window with 4 bikes.
Yes.
Who all should be running very closely together.
Yes. Based on their times throughout the last couple of days, they should be very tight. So that's a lot of pressure on that team to try and get those guys in and out on their way. We've talked a lot about CSPK. Let's round out this by talking about just some of the things that you guys have noticed from maybe some of the other names that are not CSPK related. One that jumps out to you and to me as well, Colin, is the number 4. I'm so interested in his story and his journey and his struggles, and specifically just this weekend being here and seeing where, you know, everybody is in their gear, ready to go out, and he's just hanging out in his pit, talking to a bunch of people, trying to, you know, maybe grease the wheels a little bit on in terms of the messaging of what was happening around his mechanics and what was happening with his bike itself. But Josh Hayes is kind of this guy that, based on my limited experience, is coming from a whole lot of, you know, whether it be mechanical or struggles or frustration, and he just kind of shows up on race day and does the damn thing. That seems to be what he's kind of about at this point.
Well, Josh Hayes' career is incredible. When I was covering Weir Endurance Racing, back when endurance racing was really big, he was a factor. He rode for the team, which is now that Vision Wheels team. That was his team. He's a multiple world, AMA national superbike champion for Yamaha. He runs a limited program mostly in super sport these days. By the way, podium finisher in CSBK at Mosport, long, long time ago.
Long ago? Let's put you on the spot.
I believe it was 90, 98, and it was a race won by Don Monroe, and Hayes was on this hybrid GSXR 1000, absolute monster motorcycle, like probably, you know, very fast, but not necessarily what you want at Mosport. And he made one heck of an impression and famously said that his mechanic had really busted a grape getting the bike ready, which we hadn't heard that expression before. That was a pretty good one. But just a popular guy. Everybody likes him. He's so knowledgeable. And it's funny, first thing this morning, I was talking to Cam in the media room about this. And I said, you know, I'm wondering if Hayes is going to get out. He had to find an engine, right? That's not the ideal situation because Josh Hayes needs a good engine. We know he can run at the front. And the moment he was out there, right away I could see it was him. Didn't have to know the color of the bike or read the number on it. It's Josh Hayes at Daytona. He rides a certain way, and it actually is that distinctive that a long way away I can recognize that it's him. I can't tell you why, but I knew it was him as soon as he came out of the pits.
Interesting, yeah. It's that feel you get from years of seeing somebody ride the way that he rides at a certain place. But what grabs your attention outside of the CSPK paddock for you, Cam?
Well, the easy answer would be Tyler Scott. I mean, I know that's really bold of me to say that the pole sitter looked really good today, but you know, he's an 18-year-old kid who has looked, you know, like a Daytona veteran this weekend. I mean, we had talked a lot about Escalante and his pace, Heron and his pace. Tyler Scott was right with them both yesterday and faster than them both today. And he's a guy that has won super sport races, even, you know, despite being 17 years old last year. You know, he did reasonably well here last year, and then I think ran into some problems late, if I remember. But, you know, he's a guy that could win and really, you know, I was going to say put himself on the map. I think he's already done that even coming into the weekend. But on the flip side is, you know, we all want to know what happened with his teammate, which is Escalante today. Because he was the guy that we were talking about and, you know, really coming into it and all day yesterday, and now he finds himself 9th on the grid.
That was interesting to me in the time attack where it's like lap record and 9th. Why?
I think that there was a certain scramble that happened when they went in for the tire, right? And I don't know that this was conscious, but it's interesting that Scott set his time by himself. And, mm-hmm. you know, the PA guys were saying it's at least a second in the draft. We've been saying we think it could be as much as 2, 1.5 is a good magic number. So that he cranked off the second best lap in the history of the Speedway on his own, marching steadily forward on the new rear tire, is impressive. And I also, it's so competitive at the front. I don't mean it's like MotoGP. It's a different category. The bikes are not nearly as fast. But in MotoGP, you know, you have an afternoon that's not quite right, and you go from third in the morning to 12th in the afternoon, even though the times are good. You're looking at the data, the tires are all okay. And I think that's a little bit what we're seeing. We've had so much compression at the front that unless you hit all your numbers right and your confidence is sky high, and I hate to be this guy, but what difference does it make where you qualify for the Daytona 200?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Like it felt like in the time attack today in the second session on track for Supersport, it was like, this is a fun circus. It's short-lived.
It was fun.
It keeps people interested going into the races because we had Super Hooligan and we had Twins and we had the Baggers. But it was like, I mean, this thing is so long and there's so much that goes into it that it's like, if you're Ben Young and you're not involved in the time attack, who cares? Like, honestly, who cares? Like, you could still end up in the front group if you do a great job and you have enough pace and you work the draft and you find somebody to run with. And like, it's so interesting to me that it's such a show, but it turned into a show of something that it's like, yeah, it means something to be in the top 12 and to get that extra showcase time. But it also is one of those things where, okay, if 3 of the guys in the top 12 struggle with mechanical issues for some random reason or run themselves into trouble or somebody makes a bad decision going into the second horseshoe and wipes them out, it's like, well, all of a sudden, the guy who's in 18th is in 14th, and now he's got a shot after maybe a red flag or something to try and take a run. And talking to Greg White, he was just like, what's the over-under on red flags in this? Like, you say 2? You think that's realistic in terms of
trying to... Well, I think 1 last year was a lot less than it probably should have been, and they're right. More competitive, and when they're running in groups, there's your risk. I think, too, that... You know, when you have so many teammates, it's very, very easy to get obsessed with their performance, right? And I think that's gonna be a problem for Scott because he's, in my opinion, got almost for sure 2 people who are really gunning for him. And it's funny because with what happened last year with Escalante and the incident with Heron,
yep.
Scott got lost in that. His incident happened around the same time, and it didn't get almost any attention, even though he was doing really well, because it was all simultaneous. And you know, you can't, sometimes a whole bunch of things go wrong at the same time. And Daytona frequently is a scramble afterwards to try to figure out what, you know, this many bikes, this many laps, what, who, you know, we're all comparing notes, right? Who saw what, who caught the bike coming in, who saw the bike in the crash truck, you know, who was at the chicane. It's a rebuild to try and figure it out. And of course, you know, people are going to be watching television, want to see the race, and they're not necessarily going to see all of our guys battling for 23rd.
This is the peak of the Bridgestone Canadian Superbike Championship as we head into the final lap. The white flag comes out.
1 lap to go.
White flag flies.
It's our last lap flag.
It's the white flag, the final lap.
Last lap flag, 1 to go.
This is my question for you, Colin. I'm going to mix up here on the white flag. The one last thought before we let you go is, does that same principle from the M4 X-Star Suzuki guys, does that apply to the ART team in terms of getting obsessed with the teammates that are riding around you and their performance? Because it feels like they have a different mentality, and they ran consistently good times, which could be the thing that gets all of them somewhere up close to the front.
I honestly think that if they execute the way they should, it's going to be like a personality disorder issue at the end. And I mean, what could possibly be better? Because I, you know, all of these guys have had real success as sprint racers, and you know, they've wound up in a team together. But who, you know, we know this from car racing. Who is the first person you have to beat and put in their place all the time? And you know, we're heading to the World Endurance Championship. What could be better than I have firmly established that I am the guy? I get the new tires. I do qualifying. and everybody focuses on me. I get the bike the way I want it. I get it comfortable, and then everybody else works through whatever the pieces of the puzzle are left. Now, of course, this is just building the most exciting story. And also, you look at car racing. You know, most of the time, like an IndyCar race or particularly a NASCAR race, nobody pays much attention to qualifying except where their teammates qualify.
Right, of course. Cam, what's on your mind?
A lot. I think, you know, this is, again, an easy target. I want to know what Kayla Yakov is going to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, she's obviously a very popular name, a polarizing name for some. Maybe deservedly so, maybe undeservedly so. But you know, the one thing you can say about her is that she's phenomenal. She's a phenomenal person. She's a phenomenal rider. She's certainly one of the youngest riders in the field, if not the youngest. I don't know that for sure. First ever appearance on a Ducati. She's done really, really well so far. How is she going to hold up over 57 laps? But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, how much does it matter for her career? Is this just a launching point? Or, you know, I want to know what sort of Kayla Yakov experience we're going to come out with tomorrow.
And the last thing I'll say is I'm just interested in what Craig White has to say, which you can listen to here on the Bridgestone CSBK podcast. It was a great interview. I super enjoyed, like, Cam was standing there the whole time. I felt bad I didn't give him a headset. And I actually asked him before we did the interview, I'm like, Cam, do you just want to come hang out? Like, Greg and I are just going to go talk about this race.
The two of you wouldn't leave any air for anyone else.
and it ended up that Cam was standing there for about half of our interview. And again, this is one of those amazing, funny things. I interviewed Kayla Yakov in the Rahal Ducati Moto pit area, like the paddock area, essentially, like their garage. And I set up the unit in there. When we start hanging out, we're talking to them. And then I go in there, I see Greg, and I just say, hey, I got a podcast over here. Do you want to come hang out? He goes, sure. And he comes over, and we end up talking for half an hour. And then at about 20 minutes into that half hour, I realized somehow we've turned Rahal's area into a media booth, where it's just two commentary guys talking about the race coming up on Saturday. And it was a super fun conversation, but I hope people get a chance to enjoy that. Download, subscribe, enjoy, follow along at CDN Superbike is where you can find all the social updates on all of the CSBK riders, of course. CSBK.ca. Enjoy this. Enjoy our interview with Kayla, with Trevor Daly, with Matt Simpson. Enjoy everything we have coming out after the race as well. And then, of course, leading into round number one, which will be in Shannonville coming up all the way in May. It feels like forever away, but as we all know, you blink and all of a sudden we're standing there in Shannonville and having fun and getting ready to do the broadcast on that as well. So, boys, thank you for this. It's been fun to tee this one up. It's going to be a great day of racing, and I hope that everybody out there enjoys it. We'll talk to you next time on the Bridgestone Canadian Superbike Championship podcast.